Right on Radio on KFAI
90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Sam. On tonight's program, Dave Fatigue talks with Patty Horvath about her debut story collection, But Now I'm Found. The characters in these stories struggle to make sense of upheaval in their lives, But Now I'm Found is a compelling exploration of the human spirit confronted by abrupt and rending change.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, Annie Harview will be in discussion with Linda Lagarde Grover about her collective memoir, Done Through Poetry, The Sky Watched. Sky Watch gives poetic voice to Ojibwe family life. Assembled in this work are voices of history, of memory, and experience as expansive and particular as the starry sky.
And good evening, Patty Horvath. Welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
We're delighted to have you. So we usually kick off pretty quick right here at the top of the hour with a reading. But before we do that, Patty, let's talk a little bit about you and how you came to write all these marvelous short stories. Your career as a writer. Why don't you give us a little background?
Well, this is actually my second book. My first published book is a memoir, All the Difference, put up by Etruscan Press a few years ago, about my experiences with disability and self-identity. I had scoliosis, my spine was fused. And I, as a reader, I'm also a writer. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, I'm also a reader, because the two things, you know, go hand in hand.
Right.
And I became really interested in the ways in which differently abled bodies have been depicted in literature, folktales, fairy tales, biblical stories. And I was looking at that and what it means to have formerly been visibly disabled. Yeah. What happens to one's sense of self when a physical disability ceases to be visible? Mm-hmm. And that, in a sense, animates the story collection as well, because a number of the stories in here, of course, have to do with illness and dying and coming to grips with that. So I guess I've long been concerned as a writer with issues of the body.
Yeah, one story in particular. One story in particular would, you know, might not necessarily be autobiographical, but one would be forgiven if one assumed there is some autobiography, correct?
The stories are largely, yes, there's half of the stories have to do, roughly half, with my childhood in Connecticut, growing up in a single parent household in Connecticut, and the other half have to do with an adult coming to. And those are largely, what links them is this notion of abandonment in its many guises. Mm-hmm. But the later stories, I wrote some of them and was working on the collection as a whole as my husband was going through treatment for terminal cancer. Okay. So that informs, that notion of loss informs the later stories in that sense. Yeah, yeah, autobiographical.
I wrote the word loss a number of times as I was reading this.
One word.
Yeah, one word. So Patty, with that as an intro, congratulations on the book, by the way, But Now I'm
Thank
Found.
You.
Black Lawrence Press.
Thank you.
Good people there. We love Black Lawrence. Let's start with that reading that you have planned for us.
And I'm going to read the last story in the book, which is called Sunrise. It's the shortest story in the book. The collection is bracketed by this story and by the opening story, Waking Nights, which are both stories about a woman waiting to hear what's happened to her child and trying to ward off the news. Mm-hmm. So this is called Sunrise. She turns in bed too early to rise, the sky sickly yellow, red-rimmed. Red in the morning, sailors take warning. But she is not adrift, mattress firm beneath her, box springs, bed frame, concrete floor. She has risen too early is all, tossing and turning through a sleepless night, no particular reason, the occasional mild disturbance she attributes to age. The sun has not yet risen, curious phrase, the sun, as we know, neither rising nor setting, fixed in the sky, unmoving, planets spinning around it, turning and turning on their axes. She does not feel this, of course, the earth's rotation. Such a thing would be intolerable, the unceasing sensation of movement, the constant reminder of time. The day has not taken a turn for the worse, figure of speech, but still. The phone has not rung. She has no premonition, no reason to be awake so early in the morning, a Sunday, the second in May, the one with flowers and cards. She lies still. She thinks of her son. He would be driving now, moving back home, another year of college completed, exams taken, courses passed. She is moved by the thought of this, the long drive east, suitcases in the well, music playing, sun in his eyes, miles to go. He would have left early, the sky barely light, would drive for hours, passing borders, towns, then states. Too soon yet to turn off the highway, too soon to stop for coffee, for gas, a quick pee. Your lights are on, thanking the attendant, looking away just long enough to do that, to switch them off, not seeing the driver, the other car running a light, looking up too late, blinded by the sun. In bed, the woman tosses and turns. Morning has not yet begun. She knows she should sleep, but the thought of him alone in the still on the still dark road causes something to rise in her, some feeling she must quell. Her fears inchoate, not concrete. She cannot put a name to them. Sleep is all. Sleep is what she needs. She turns on the light. Soon he will be here. The phone has not rung. And though she cannot feel it, the earth is still moving. No way to make this moment stop. Though later, sooner than she can know, that is all that she will want.
That is all that she will want. You just broke up a little bit at the end there. I wanted people to hear the last phrase.
That's all we want.
Yes, that is Patricia Horvath reading from the short story collection, But Now Am Found. Let's talk a little bit about Waking Nights and Sunrise. The two stories that bookmark, as you said, the collection, both of them pushed my parental anxiety buttons, I must say. Nothing more fearsome, worrisome than a child in, you know, possible danger. And it's the possible that can make you crazy, right, as a parent. Why did you put these stories where you put them? This sounds very deliberate.
Well, they speak to each other, I think. They're about the ways in, you know, when my husband was passing away, my doctor told me denial is a powerful survival tool. And I think in a sense, these stories are both about denial. In Waking Nights, this woman just keeps playing solitaire over, and she starts playing solitaire, then she can't, then she starts doing crossword puzzles, and she's just doing anything to push this fear away, the same way that the woman in the story doesn't want to think, she wants to go back to bed, she can't, but I'm interested in, like, how do we deal with abrupt and rending change? And I should say probably that I'm not a parent. My publisher, Diane Ghetto, when she called to tell me they were accepting the book, was saying, oh, you know, as a parent, these stories move me. I know you must know something about how this feels. And I don't. It's just imagination. It's just lost in a different guise. There's another story in there about a young man whose girlfriend goes away to Bible camp. And that story received the Bellevue Literary Review's Goldenberg Award.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. The editor called me up and said, I'm religious too. I went to, you know, I know you, I'm from that same kind of background, and I'm not at all. I had just driven around some camp up in Canada that looked really desolate and scary and became fascinated by it. But I love that. I love when, you know, the imagination, because I've always had a hard time distinguishing a little bit between what's real and what's imagined.
Right. Well, those are beautiful stories. Yeah. You're clearly good at this. So these two stories, they're brief. Almost poetic, almost poetry-like. Do you write poems, Patricia?
I wish I did.
Well, you do. You do inside these stories. I really feel like you do.
Thank you.
They're powerful. They're beautifully written.
Somehow when I try to write them as poems, so they just don't work.
Is that right?
I'm jealous of my poet friends.
Yeah. Some of these stories, and the one you just mentioned, and But Now I'm Found, the title piece, Griswold, Never Let Go. These are stories for me that could have been novels because I loved the characters, and I was sorry that I wasn't going to be with them after, you know, the story ran out.
Given me some ideas.
Let's talk about stories and why you settle on the short story form, why you write short stories.
Well, I don't exclusively write short stories. My first book was a memoir. Right. I'm working on an essay collection now, but I love stories. I really do. And mm-hmm. people have said to me, well, you know, story collections don't sell. Mm. And that may or may not be true, but I mean, that's not the primary reason I think why writers write. Most of us, we're trying to explore something about, I know I write out of what I term vexation and inquiry. Something's bothering me and I have to try to figure it out.
Huh.
And I love stories. And the first things that we hear when we're children are once upon a time, right?
Right, exactly.
Those of us who are writers and we hear those words and we know to suspend our disbelief and we're going to be in a world of magic.
Mm-hmm.
And fairy tales and the supernatural inform some of these stories. There's a girl who thinks she can communicate with spirits via a Ouija board.
Mm-hmm.
There's a girl who's trying to turn herself into a witch. Mm-hmm. There is a woman who thinks that if she leaves cakes on her son's gravestone, she can somehow communicate with him. Mm-hmm. That's what that blurring between the once upon a time fairy tale world and the world we live in is fascinating to me.
It is fascinating. We'll come back to some of that. When you were talking about writing and publishing, you reminded me of in Value Added. Now, I have a printout of your book. I don't have the bound version, so it's on my page 82.
Not out until next week. That's why.
Well, that's why. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, this is hot off the press. You can pre-order this baby right now.
February 17th.
February 17th, people. Get in line. Go camp out. Anyway, there's this passage in Value Added where the narrator, and maybe we'll have you read some Value Added. It's a funny piece. Talks about writing some poems and putting them out there, and I can read some of it. Nevertheless, I'd sent the promising poems into the world, and a couple of them appeared in journals that two or three people might have actually read and encouraged. I wrote some more poems and sent those out too, and so on. I like this moment because it's kind of a meta moment in a way. Of course, a writer's talking about doing this, and I thought I'd ask you about why writers do this. You could write these stories for yourself, but we put them into the world, just like your character here put the poems into the world. I've never asked the writer this question before, but what makes a writer want to bind the stories up? And
keep them in a drawer?
Yeah.
That's a really good question. I sometimes ask myself that too. You know, when I write something and it's not working, why?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good question. I think there's something about communicating. Okay. I mean, a lot of these stories, first of all, let me just back up a minute and say thank you for saying that Value Added is funny, because if you tell someone you've written a collection and the stories are largely about grief and abandonment, you know.
Exactly.
and some of the stories I have been told are funny, and I find that very gratifying. So thank you for saying that.
Absolutely.
I think we all have things we want to communicate. And when we're writing, we're trying to, you know, we're imagining a reader, and we're imagining maybe saying, you know, here I am in this situation, or here my narrator is in the situation. I've got something I'm trying to figure out about loss or grief or abandonment or disability or joy or what have you. And maybe that will spark something in you too. Mm-hmm. So in some ways I'm having a conversation in my head with the reader when I write.
I like that.
That's why I'm sending these stories out into the world.
You've solved the riddle of why writers write and put their words out in the world. And that makes perfect sense. That's beautiful. So let's keep talking about humor. I read an essay by Jane Smiley once, who, you know, wrote a funny novel, a comic novel. But she of course said, once you say that, it's not funny. Once you tell people it's funny, it's not funny. She wrote a long, beautiful essay on that whole issue of it. So
I'm glad you said it instead of me.
But you pull it off. Were you trying? Do you try for humor, or does it happen? Do your characters just come alive, and do the scenes happen on their own? How does that magic thing happen?
I don't know that I'm trying to be funny. I don't think I'm trying. I just think that sometimes sometimes the best way into something that is serious or grim in some matter is mm-hmm. through humor. I mean, you look at the history of humor, and it's often used to address really dark subjects.
Yeah.
I don't, I mean, I know when I've written something that's funny, but I don't sit down and go, I'm going to be funny now. And I don't think that would really work.
Right. That's right. Thank you. Right. I also think as a reader and everyone listening to this program reads, and we spend most of our time in the world with other people trying to be pleasant, cracking mm-hmm. a joke if we can. We spend a mm-hmm. lot of time trying to be not offensive to people, and mm-hmm. and those efforts rarely show up, in my view, in fiction, because writers can be very concerned about the big idea that they forget that we're just shuffling along. So instead of putting aside loss and grief, three sort of grounding themes for me in these stories are place, family, and then character. I'm going to start with the last one. You make choices in these stories to write from a particular point of view. How do you do that? You really write confidently from, a child's point of view, a young person's point of view, older person's point of view, et cetera, et cetera. It's a silly question to ask how you do that, but how do you decide how to approach a story?
Well, it's not always, sometimes it just happens naturally. It's not always easy with But Now I'm Found. It was written originally from the point, it's a story, But Now I'm Found is a story about a young man who is dating a woman who wears a back brace for scoliosis, which is what I wore. Mm-hmm. And he's in love with her, they're teenagers, and she eventually gets sent to Bible camp by her parents and gets saved. She tells him, she dumps him and says, you know, I'm saved and you're not. So I'm in moral certitude is something I'm really interested in. Mm-hmm. But I originally wrote that story from her point of view. And I found her so unlikable that it was unworkable. Huh. And I thought, well, what about the boy? Let's try this from his perspective. So that was kind of a little bit of a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Other stories, I just took things from one, particularly the stories that are set where the narrators are young.
Mm-hmm.
Those are often first person stories, and those are often just, I start out with, let me tell this story about what happened to me. And then as I'm writing it, I change enough things that it becomes fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this sense of myself as a younger person in some of the stories.
Sure, sure.
I mean, it was actually in that sense, pretty seamless to, I didn't have to make those decisions.
I also imagined you as someone in the health profession. Because you write so beautifully of scenes in hospitals or people.
I
otherwise.
Spent a lot of time in hospitals in my life, let me tell you. So that is another that I did not have to imagine, unlike the Bible camp.
Yeah. I mentioned place and family. Family is here through and through.
Mm-hmm.
And do you tap your own family for your stories?
Well, I do. I mean, you'll notice in those families that there's most of them are characterized by absentee fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that certainly was my experience when I talk about how abandonment is something that is linking them. It's, you know, in myriad guises, there's the abandonment of people rejecting each other on religious grounds. There's the abandonment unwilling of death. People dying, which is a form of abandonment, even if they don't necessarily want to. But also when I was a child, my father left. He more or less disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a kind of an abandonment that I was always struggling to come to terms with
mm-hmm.
that informs many of the stories. And so you have a family of a mother and a narrator, and sometimes there's a sibling, often a sister in these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not my family. For one thing, I don't have a sister, but it's that, and then again, it is because we were a family without a father figure.
Right, right. I want to come back to value added. I'm looking at the time and what these moments go really fast. And yeah, they really do. Maybe I think you have a little reading for us from Value Added, that story, or maybe you can give us some words, give us a sense for that.
Sure. I'm just going to read the first two pages of that. I can talk about the story's genesis if you want to afterwards.
Please, that'd be great.
So this is called Value Added, A More Fabulous You. First thing was, my hair was disappearing. Each morning in the shower, handfuls came loose from my scalp. I'd pull entire chia pets from the drain, wrap them in tissue, and toss them away. "Breakage," said Jack. He swiveled the hairdresser's chair so I was in profile. A wan woman, pink smocked, too much nose, too little chin. Jack combed out a damp section, pulled it taut. "Blonde or thin hair," he said. "I'm not blonde." "We could fix that," he snapped his fingers. "God knows what possessed me. Change the color," Jack said, "and that's what people will see. Platinum. Don't be timid." He swiveled me to face him, his own hair dark, ample, gelled stiff. "We'll reshape it, too." Jack painted my hair with a solution that reeked of ammonia. He wrapped my head in foil, and I sat like that in the window of Hair Today, flipping through magazines, reading articles like "Value Added, Invest in a More Fabulous You," which contained tips on where to find hand-milled French soaps at $40 a bar, how to apply gold-flecked eyeshadow for those 24-karat occasions, and why a simple toe-straightening procedure was a must for the new summer footwear. I read Plastic Surgery Successes, featuring the human Barbie doll, and a couple who, after getting plastic surgery, decided to sign up their children, too, so that they would look more like a family. I did not want to stop reading. "Time's up," Jack said. He peeled back the foil and began to cut. My hair, when he finished, looked terrific and completely wrong. It looked as though it had sprouted cherub wings, lifted itself from Miley Cyrus's head, and, fluttering briefly, plopped itself down on my skull. Miley. Now that was a blonde's name. Miley, Marlena, Marilyn, May, not Sarah. A woman, 127 years old, practically barren, and married to the biggest grouch in the Bible. Or the dessert lady, the one whose bland portrait appears on boxes of cheesecake, coffee cake, what have you. Or a woman who teaches freshman composition and the occasional theme course, Man in Lit, Man in Society, Man, Woman, Lit in Society, at a community college whose students, bleary-eyed, sulking, pretended not to notice that their professor had just gone all femme fatale. Perhaps they simply didn't care. There was that. Perhaps, like my colleagues cramped together in the adjunct office, which was the name given a converted storage room, they mistook indifference for discretion. "Look at you." This, the biggest reaction I got, came from the frilly poet, a fossilized woman in ruffles and pearls who lorded it over the rest of us because in addition to comp, she taught an introductory creative writing course each spring and had published a chapbook long since consigned to that limbo where out of print books languish. The frilly poet's husband was an acquisitions lawyer, though she was mum about what he acquired. She didn't need to work. She told us this, especially as she had a lucrative sideline writing greeting card verse. Lucrative, her word. Nevertheless, she'd been at the college approximately 100 years. If she ever retired, I was in line to teach her creative writing course, a thing she knew and disliked me for. I could tell by the comments she made, comments like, "Oh, Sarah, are you teaching comp again this semester?" The frilly poet and I shared a desk with two other adjuncts, but we'd each been assigned our very own mini locker. Mine was on the top row. I had to stretch to reach the combination lock. And that was the second thing, because you see, I was shrinking. Oh. And the narrator just keeps getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah, it's really something. Patricia Horvath reading from her short story collection out next week from Black Lawrence Press, but now am found. We have a couple of minutes left here. Tell us the genesis of this story. You're going to do that.
I was diagnosed with full-blown osteoporosis when I was still in my 30s. Mm-hmm. And I had just moved to New York. I discovered because I went for a routine exam, a baseline exam, and I had shrunk. And I was not even 40 yet.
Wow.
And it occurred to me, so this was, you know, in the turn of the century, during the boom, not the bust. And so these, you know, ads that I'm using in the story were things I actually saw on the subway, and the article about I did not make that up, about the family wanting to have their kids have plastic surgery, I saw in a magazine somewhere, and I thought, this is a serviceable metaphor.
Oh my God.
the creative person in the consumerist vortex is, you know, the shrinking is a very serviceable metaphor here.
Absolutely.
Shrinking, and nobody notices, and you disappear.
Right. Right.
Right.
Exactly. Beautiful. Well said. I want to talk about your forthcoming book, the things you're working on right now, a book of essays, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
What's driving that? What's your theme? Do you have one, or are you going to?
I do. It's a collection of essays about my experiences simultaneously as a caretaker for my husband when he was terminally ill, and a cancer patient myself, because I was a cancer patient I had just finished cancer treatment when he was diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's coming to terms with that. It's about the experiences of caring for somebody during COVID when we were alone and the hospice people wouldn't even come because of the virus, and, you know, about coming to grips with loss. And again, the essays, even though the subject matter may sound indeed bleak, the essays are not entirely without humor. And I've structured them around the ideas of the seven deadly sins and the seven cardinal virtues.
Oh.
So there's patience and chastity and charity and lust. And that was because when I was writing these initially, I thought I need to get some distance from them. And the notion of sin and corollary virtues seemed to me a serviceable way to do that, to get a little distance from the material. I was reading Mary Jo Bang's translation of the Inferno at the time.
Oh, wow.
And that's what gave me the idea.
Wow. Well, that sounds powerful. And, you know, as you suggested, I will say this about the short stories. We talked a lot about loss and grief and so on. But these are not stories sort of drenched in sadness by any stretch. They're full of life. They're full of truly enchanting characters that we very quickly care about. And I'm telling you, Patricia, we want more from them. At least I do.
Oh, thank you.
And I think your readers will. So I'm sure that's also true of the essays. Have the essays appeared anywhere that we should be looking? They have.
They've been in one of Patience was in the Massachusetts Review. Envy was in New Ohio Review. Wrath was in the Los Angeles Review. If they're on, I think if you go to my website, which is patricialhorvath.com.
Oh, great.
You can see some of them.
Okay.
But I think about five of them were published. And I was fortunate because I was on sabbatical last year. So after my husband passed away, I was not in a state where I could write initially. And I slowly got back into writing these by writing in my journal. And I was able to complete the collection. So now I am in the process of editing it and making these discrete essays into a cohesive whole.
Wonderful. And I'm sure they're going to be amazing.
Thank you.
Hey, Patricia, keep us in mind when that book's out, okay?
Absolutely.
Awesome. And we have been speaking with Patricia Horvath about her new short story collection, But Now Am Found, out next week from Black Lawrence Press. Please look it up, folks, and check her out. Google her, Patricia Horvath, H-O-R-V-A-T-H. And Patricia, thank you. What a delight.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Great. Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. And now this.
We are just about to have a great conversation with Linda Lagarde Grover. She is an author in multiple genres. She is a faculty emeritus at University of Minnesota Duluth, and she is a member of the Bois Fort Ojibwe here in Minnesota. We had her on last year for Gichigami Hearts, which was super fun, and we're excited to have her back this time for poetry.
Okay, we're good. All right, I'm going to hang up the other phone, okay?
Awesome. Great. Hi, Linda. Thank you so much for joining us on KFAI. It's really great to have you back.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to talk with you again.
Thank you. Last time we had you here, it was for Gichigami Hearts. We're having you back now for The Sky Watched. Could you tell us a little about your creative practice and how poetry, nonfiction, other things you write fit together?
Well, I think everything that I do wraps back to Anishinaabe history, Ojibwe history, and to my own family's experiences. And so The Sky Watched, I think, follows that pattern in four sections, where I begin this collection with some poetry about some of the old time teachings. And then from there, you know, after establishing, you know, the foundation of our ways of being, Anishinaabe beliefs and spirituality, then the impact of colonial experience is really the next section, and really focusing on the boarding school experiences and with my family's and other people's experiences. These are, you know, I would really call this nonfiction. And so in the next section there, it is the aftermath of that, of trying to pick up the pieces and gather ourselves together and to pull strength from what was already there, in spite of the great beating that things took. And then the fourth section is being an Anishinaabe woman today. So it kind of interlaced with these, though, are experiential things. They are, there's poetry here about, listening to something at the Duluth Symphony, and just going about my daily life, or kind of an interaction with a sculpture by Gordon Van Wert that was in the Tweed Sculpture Garden here at the University of Minnesota Duluth. And so this is a reissue of a book that was published some years ago, and it is revised and expanded. And I think with the experience of years, I think it has made the collection richer.
Did you add anything for this reissued edition?
Yes, I added quite a bit, actually. So I think that every single poem in here has been revised, and then it's reordered somewhat. But yes, there is more poetry in here, newer poetry, and it's not in its own section, though. It is kind of interspersed as it works, you know, within the whole collection.
Yeah. As you talked about kind of the trajectory of the book and kind of the way things pull together towards the end, and it ends on a really nice thing with gratitude towards being Ojibwe and gratitude towards your Ojibwe community and heritage passed down from your father. You talk about the Ojibwe concept of a good life in the book, especially the introduction. Do you want to tell a little bit about how that informed your process and how where you wanted the book to go?
We are taught as Anishinaabe people to be thankful for things. Mm-hmm. And so from a very early age, we try to instill that in our children, mm-hmm. to understand, first of all, that, you know, we were created here. We have purpose there. You know, we all have something that we are supposed to be doing to contribute to our family, tribe, community, the world. But we understand that we didn't create this. And for that, we are thankful people. We understand that we've been given many, many gifts. Everything is a gift. And because of that, we really are supposed to be in this walking the good road here, becoming people who are generous, you know, with tangible things, but really most importantly is developing the best we can a generosity of spirit. And so that works in kind of a spiraling through generations. And I begin, you know, I introduce the book in that way, and I hope that is present all the way through. And yes, at the end, then I do finish it with the, you know, kind of reinforcing that a poem that I wrote in honor of Joy Harjo's poem Becoming 70, you know, doing this in response to her and reinforcing the idea that we are very fortunate to get to be older people.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I really, that's great. I feel like we mainstream culture is so youth focused, and it really takes away from the honor and the exciting thing that is growing to be old. To dig in a little more into some stuff that was super interesting in the book, there are a couple poems that I think that I read several times, because I think they pushed back really nicely on ways that when white people try to engage with native culture or native land that can inherently either minimize or commodify like native experiences and native realities. I'm especially thinking about the poem that riffs off Robert Frost and talks about land acknowledgments, as well as the poem "To a White Woman Who Bought Dream Interpretation Cards." I love the phrase mm-hmm. "spiritual concession stand." Do you want to talk a little about kind of how, I guess, how you congeal, like, this is very broad and I'd love for you to take it wherever you want, but like how you kind of were able to encapsulate kind of the broad range of things that these, I guess, coping engagements, I don't know, want to say, that white people try to do about the ways that they've behaved towards others, like how you wanted to engage with those, I guess, and how you wanted to discuss those and give them dimension.
Yes, the one to the woman who bought the what is it called, Native American spirituality dream interpretation cards. I actually was standing behind her at a Barnes and Noble, and she had this on reserve, and so she was there to pick it up, and mm-hmm. And I mean, I certainly wasn't going to say anything, but I thought, my goodness, what are you purchasing here, or what do you think that you're purchasing? Mm-hmm. And in my poem, in reaction to that situation, I would like to say that, you know, she's looking for something, but what she's looking for, she probably isn't going to see in a set of dream interpretation cards, and it isn't actually for sale. Mm-hmm. It's there. You know, what we know in our experience and what we're trying to learn, you know, it's something, it would be free. It would be without price. How is that big mm-hmm. spectrum there? And yeah. So that one, you know, I talked about in that poem about, yeah, buying charms, buying crystals, you know, what are you looking for when you're looking to purchase this? You can't purchase Indianness, I think, mm-hmm. is what I was saying. Mm-hmm. And then the one about, you know, the loss and a question, which is kind of a parallel for me to Robert Frost's Love and a Question. Mm-hmm. And his poem is about how much is a person expected to do? How much is a nice person, a good person, really expected to give? How much? And so that one really is about when a land acknowledgement statement is read. So often those are read at the beginning of some type of gathering, and it's, you know, they're read by a non-native person, but they're always when I first read this poem aloud, a man told me, yeah, he said, those statements are kind of cringy. I said, yeah, they are. So some people have started calling them land acquisition statements, mm-hmm. or at least I have. And so what does it mean when this acknowledgement is read? What exactly is being acknowledged? And mm-hmm. importantly, too, to those who no longer perhaps have what you might call legal title to land, how much are they expected to give, mm-hmm. and for what reason? Mm-hmm. And so that kind of bothers much more when I would hear a Native person being asked to read that land acknowledgement statement, and yeah. they're up there reading it, and I go, oh my goodness, you know, what are we saying here?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like the amount that is given in giving a land acknowledgement is just so perfunctory and measly. Just to kind of touch on one more thing that I thought was an interesting, I guess, interaction between having an embodied experience as an individual who is Native in Minnesota, when you're talking about in one of your poems, you were talking about being young and walking to your office job in your nylons and walking past like white people dressed for a party in like basically Native American style getup, just kind of complicating the experience of like you can have a lived experience as something that differs so much from dressing as it. And I think that that's something that this book encompasses really well. Like, you have traditional, you have both very traditional, like, Nana Bougeot and Nokomis, Wendigo, kind of fundamental stories starting the book, kind of an opening, and you really do bring it into the contemporary. How did you choose what to include in this book? In that full scope, from walking to work in your nylons to, like, foundational tales of your heritage.
Well, you know, in that poem, it is called Casualty Days, and I'm remembering when I was working, when I was young, it was my first real job as a telephone operator, and I can remember walking to work, and there were other younger people, and, you know, I went through the seasons on this, you know, summer, fall, winter, summer, but walking past a group of college students who were home for the summer, and they were kind of socializing, semi-socializing, semi-having like an anti-war protest, and, you know, chanting about Ho Chi Minh and stuff, and not seeing girls like me at all. And so, you know, I'm walking around there in a dress for work and nylons, and, you know, carrying a plastic purse, and just came face to face with a non-Indian girl, a white girl, who was wearing a beaded headband and chanting and raising her fist in the air and just generally having a really good time. And, you know, we went in and went to work on the switchboard, where some of the girls there were engaged to or had boyfriends who were in Vietnam. And, you know, how this must have hurt their hearts, you know, as they're walking in past people who didn't really see us as, I don't know, as equal human beings. And so seeing that girl in the headband, and it was a beaded headband, and very kind of, you know, nothing that I would wear, something that in those days made in Japan would be something that was like some type of cheap import. And I think that's what she was wearing. And it was like, I'm putting on Indian trappings here and signaling in some way what I am, and then being completely oblivious to a Native girl who's walking past her to work and stepping over on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's sometimes there is just that jarring of experience where here is the reality of right now, and are people really aware that they are walking, you know, they are standing, breathing, walking, going to school on land where, you know, where our ancestors experienced some really difficult things and were made to exit.
Mm-hmm. Then in throughout this book, in that situation, it's very kind of clear that you're being embodied as your younger self. There are, and I think that you do a good job of embodying not only yourself in different places in your life, but also a variety of experiences or characters, like everything from other people to sea smoke views on Gechigami. It feels very lived in, this whole book. Is there any sort of process you do to, I guess, I don't want to say get into character because that sounds too campy, but to like get into the headspace of whatever perspective you're writing from?
I think I begin to write. Usually I have some sort of idea and then I begin to write. Mm-hmm. And I revise a lot and rewrite a lot, and poems are never really finished. I mean, a friend of mine, Ellie Schoenfeld, a poet here in Duluth area, just mentioned that once, that, you know, this is the form they're in right now when they're on the page. And so the poems continue their own life. And we as the writers revisit them sometimes and rewrite and understand that they aren't finished any more than we are finished. Mm-hmm. You know, they do have their own entity, I guess, their own lives. So I sit down, I start, and if I don't feel like it's, you know, I write until I think it's about time to stop, and then I revisit it again. Mm-hmm. I often have a few things going on, reading and writing both at the same time. I'm one of these people who has several books going at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have several things I'm writing on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I do try to prepare with, you know, thought and mm-hmm. and prayer. I mean, we Anishinaabe people, we pray a lot, you know, we pray our thanks and pray, you know, for guidance, you know, to walk the good life, the good road to live, mm-hmm. you know, mina bimad as you win the good life the best we can. And that is integrated into what I write also, I think.
That's really great. Is there anything where you had a living poem that you revisited in the Sky Watched, this new edition, that you feel went in a really different direction than it was previously? Or do you feel like they all kind of just expanded upon what they were before?
You know, I think they expanded to what they were meant to be.
Oh.
You know, one of the poems is about a portrait that hangs in the hall in Bohannon Hall at UMD of a man who was the college president years ago. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, you know, have any realization of this when I was working there, when I was a secretary there, and the portrait was in a back room, and eventually one of the deans brought it out and had it put in a nice spot in the hallway there, and I'd stop and I'd look at it and look at the little introduction at the bottom of who he was, and I realized one day, and I'd look at him, and he just seemed, you know, such a calm person, and mm-hmm. I'd look at his life and just trying to see what I could see in there. And I realized at some point that his time in the College of Education here mm-hmm. coincided with the time of my grandmother's children's removals to boarding schools.
Oh.
And so while he was school educating teachers who would be perpetuating the, you know, schooling education, that is like the American dream of people being able to go to school. At that same time, my grandmother's children were being removed and they were being sent to a whole different type of schooling education, which mm-hmm. was a convoluted American dream. I mean, we love the idea of, you know, people getting to learn things and go to school and have good lives. But the schooling that my grandmother's kids received was not intended for that.
Yeah.
And so as I looked at him, I think this poem was gelling over a long period of time. And then one day I just sat down and started to write.
I think that that's such a great connection. Unfortunately, we're running out of time right now. So I just want to close out by asking you, what are you working on right now, if anything, that you're looking forward to?
I will have a novel out this fall.
Oh,
and it's it continues the three fictions that I have earlier about a fictional Native reserve reservation in northern Minnesota and town and the people who live there, the extended family and community.
Well, cool. Well, I'll definitely keep my eyes open for that. Thank you so much for joining us today, Linda. It was really nice to speak with you again.
Oh, miigwech, Annie. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
You too.